You are listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting, as always, here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, on your radio dial, that is. Of course, we are also streaming live at CITR.ca, and of course, available by a podcast whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, welcome to the show, everybody. This is episode 49 of The Sector. And the big news is that we are now broadcasting out of our brand new studio in the new Student Union building here at UBC. The Nest, the not greatly named Nest, but whatever, we'll manage. And the new station is operational, so hooray for that. Very exciting time, and hopefully, if you haven't already, you've gotten a chance to come by, take a look. I'm sure you can get a tour, and it's quite fancy, so just saying. Well, again, we have a fantastic show today. Lots to discuss, some interesting news going on in the world of social justice in the nonprofit sector. Locally, the big news has been on the forest fires here in BC. And a few days ago, they blanketed Vancouver and the rest of the Lower Mainland in smog. Well, smoke, really, but absolutely just terrible, this sort of acidic smoke just wafting over the city. Left everything with this kind of orange haze. It was very eerie, but also just really, really hard on the lungs, actually. Fortunately, that seems to have blown away for now, but of course, we wish well to everybody who have been displaced by the fires in the interior. They're just raging out of control. We wish well to the firefighters who are trying to combat those deadly flames. You know, I was actually kind of thinking about this the other day, and it's kind of sad, but it seems like this is going to be the new norm. Dealing with major forest fires in BC, given the fact that with climate change reducing our summers to a very dry, very hot, and very windy time period, that's only going to make these outbreaks more likely. And of course, if you also think about the scarcity of water, as you know, that's been in the news lately, that's also going to make things a bit harder for preserving the forest. But also, you know, the way that with all the wind and the way that, you know, the Rockies kind of create this buffer, it's probably going to be a lot more likely and a regular occurrence that we're going to get these days where the smoke will just blow right down the province, blanketing, you know, Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And this is just something that we're going to have to get used to from now on. And it's really kind of sad. It's very unfortunate that we've allowed climate change and sort of this huge lack of action on the part of government from really doing anything tangible about it. And now we have to live with this new horrible reality. And it's really unfortunate. But this is the situation that we're in now. And I guess we're going to have to find ways not so much to fix it, but to cope with it. Well, anyway, it's depressing, but that's something that I was thinking about. So let me know what your thoughts on that. You can email them to us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com, as well as tweet them at sectorpodcast or at Ethan Clow, that's me, on Twitter. And I'd like to hear your thoughts. You sort of envision a very kind of smoke-filled future here in BC thanks to these forest fires. So on today's show, we're going to be talking a bit about some local news here in Vancouver. Local, but with global repercussions, so to speak. One of the big things that's happened here in Vancouver, which you probably heard about, was the Women's World Cup of FIFA. So soccer, or football to the rest of the world, is on everybody's mind. And I thought we could talk a bit about some of the social justice-related issues that have cropped up, specifically about this World Cup event, not so much the rest of FIFA, which we've talked about a bit in the past. So we'll touch on that, as well as there was a recent referendum here in Vancouver, the Greater Vancouver area, actually, to expand transit operations and transit services. Now, this referendum involved a raising taxes for the Lower Mainland to finance this expansion for transit. Now, not surprisingly, this failed to get it past the voters. So we're going to look at a bit about why that failed, what it says about Vancouver and our perceptions of transit, and what it says about our perceptions of how transit makes our city better and more livable, as well as some of the ramifications of putting this to a referendum. What does that even mean? And why was this a vote? Why wasn't this just something that was done by policymakers and politicians because it was a needed service? So we'll dive into that as well. Again, it's a really interesting issue because, you know, transit has a very unique relationship, I think, in the greater Vancouver area and how we kind of perceive the value of our city. But we'll get into that a bit later on in the show. Also, we have a short story that I want to mention involving charities in Canada and human rights. So we will dive into that after the break. We'll be right back here on The Sector, here on CITR, after these messages. So stay tuned, and we will see you very soon.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
God, ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody, God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Ugh.
Isn't there anything, 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 anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider, and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
And we are back here on The Sector discussing the role of nonprofits and social justice with me, Ethan Clow, on CITR. Just a reminder that if you want to check out our webpage, it's at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. There you will find all of our show notes as well as past episodes for you to download and listen to. So hurrah! And of course, if you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can do so at that website or at citr.ca under the shows and podcast tab. Well, as I said, fantastic show today. Our first story comes to us, actually, thanks to a friend and listener, Michael, thanks for the story, regarding the Canadian, well, various Canadian charities taking their concerns about the charity chill, the advocacy chill, if you were, to the UN. Specifically, we have the charity Canada Without Poverty, which is actually in Geneva, talking with the United Nations about the Canadian Revenue Agency's program of auditing charities. The CEO, or executive director, of Canada Without Poverty, Harriet McLaughlin, is pleading her case before the UN Human Rights Committee, arguing that the audit program that was launched by the Conservative government in 2012 violates Canada's international commitment on human rights. In an article on the CBC, which I will have a link to in our show notes on our website, McLaughlin says that the ruling that limits 10% of the resources of a charity to political activities is effectively silencing groups like hers, which attempt to hold the government of Canada responsible for various human rights violations or various human rights related issues around the mandate of her charity. And this could also apply to any other organization that requires and indeed needs to speak out about any kind of issue related to poverty or income or class or race or human rights. If that can be interpreted as being political and therefore banned, that is an infringement on their ability to not only do their job, but also to express themselves and to raise the conversation here in Canada about human rights, which is something that you would think that the UN Human Rights Committee would be a little bit concerned about. In a quote in the article, if we want to make a petition or part of some kind of gathering, a protest, there's a fear there that we are stepping over the bound. And again, you know, we've actually kind of seen this play itself out in many different charities over the last little while, particularly with this sort of notion of if your political statement happens to go against the current government's political viewpoint, that's being interpreted as a political attack and not an expression of, you know, charity mandate, which I don't really know how to describe that, because again, if your cause is the environment and you are protesting a policy or law that directly impacts the environment, if that's being interpreted as a political attack, that's a very kind of 1984-ish view of the universe. Now, this is not just a question of Canadian charities taking their concerns to the UN. This is actually part of Canada itself, as a signer of the UN Human Rights Committee, being under review. Each year, they review the human rights records of a handful of the 168 countries that have signed the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And since it's Canada's turn, there are a lot of different groups right now at the UN talking about Canada's record on human rights. This includes groups like Amnesty International, who are raising issues of abuses here in Canada, including the murdered and missing Aboriginal women here in Canada, the residential school program, as well as the lack of action from our government on these particular issues. Now, of course, as these groups raise these concerns, the Canadian officials, the politicians, whatnot, will attempt to answer these questions, and the panel will release its findings on July 23rd. But, you know, getting back to Canada Without Poverty for a moment, on the article it actually says that their revenue last year was $318,000, which is pretty small by charity standards. I mean, a lot of these larger organizations have excess millions of dollars. So that's I would classify this as a very, very, fairly small organization, right? Now, they estimate that about 8% of their resources went into political activity. Now, for a group that is mostly an advocacy-based organization, that would seem very reasonable. Because, again, this is not one of those organizations that runs soup kitchens or food drives. They do things through policy advocacy and reaching out through policymakers, politicians, government, infrastructure, etc., trying to lessen the impact of poverty and try to improve, you know, Canada's support, etc. So the idea here that an organization like this is being subject to CRA scrutiny because of the fact that they are doing what their mandate requires of them is a little bit, you know, it's a little bit disingenuous. It's not really in the spirit of why the CRA exists in the first place. And I think it also kind of speaks to this notion that perhaps the kind of motivation behind some of these audits, and again, you know, the CRA has repeatedly said there is no political motivation behind these audits, and, you know, the CRA is operating independently from the government, and that's really been called into question, I think, over the past year or so. But the kind of idea here that it seems like a lot of the attention is being focused on these advocacy charities, and that there seems to be this push to kind of force charities to operate within that kind of limited scope of you know, running a soup kitchen, running a church group, running, you know, a clothing drive or whatever, it is not, there's no real sympathy or interest or indeed any kind of drive on the part of government or policymakers like the CRA to encourage charities to do anything other than sort of baseline activity. You know, they don't want to see organizations doing advocacy. They don't want to see organizations out there organizing protests, organizing civil disobedience, talking to the UN, that sort of thing. They want to see charities, you know, spooning out soup. And, you know, again, like it sort of seems like what their view of a charity is compared to what the rest of Canada wants their charity sector to do. So, you know, it's an interesting subject. We'll keep our eye on this. I mean, July 23rd, that's not far away at all. So hopefully there'll be some interesting responses from this. We will cover that when it comes up here on the sector. Anyway, let's take a quick break here on the show. We will return after this with more great content here on the sector on CITR. Stay tuned.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bill and Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And we are back here on the sector with me, Ethan Clow, talking about the world of nonprofits and social justice right here on CITR. Now, before the break, I mentioned that we'd be talking a bit about the World Cup. So specifically, the Women's World Cup, which actually took place here in Vancouver. And you may have actually, if you're local, went to a game or seen some of the coverage. Apparently, I didn't get a chance to. I was busy, but from what I understand, it was an amazing atmosphere. Lots of fans around, lots of good times, great games. Overall, just really fantastic. I mean, it wasn't so successful from a Canadian point of view because Canada didn't really do all that well, and which is unfortunate because we were, you know, one of the better teams. But that being said, good for the sport, good for the overall growth of women's soccer, and definitely showing that, you know, Canada and the U.S. and countries that don't necessarily have the biggest soccer traditions or heritage, definitely showing that these countries, we are really starting to get onto the soccer bandwagon. So that's really cool. I'm sure that, like, the Whitecaps, the Vancouver Whitecaps, are very happy with that, and I'm sure it's going to have a lot of great positive effects. That being said, it's not without its controversy. A number of things have happened that definitely shine a light on the fact that women's soccer is clearly not as respected as the men's soccer. And in some cases, there are some pretty antiquated notions going around about women's sports in general. No sooner had England finished their World Cup run when one of the tweets regarding women's soccer sort of hit the Twitterverse. It was actually deleted fairly quickly, but basically said, I'll quote it from the actual tweet, "Our lionesses go back to being mothers, partners, and daughters today, but they have taken another title, heroes." So, you know, on the surface, might seem a little bit innocuous, but then, of course, you go back and say, okay, well, yeah, but aren't a lot of the women's soccer players on the England national team, aren't they professional soccer players anyway? So it's not like they're going back to being housewives. They're going back to their jobs and being, you know, professional soccer players. A lot of people reacted quite strongly to this and felt that this was a very kind of gendered, traditional viewpoint that, you know, these women, their normal job, their 24/7 job is to be, you know, mothers and daughters and whatnot. And playing soccer is just sort of like that, you know, like a little vacation. And that once that's done, okay, it's great, you did a good job, now go back to being housewives. And a lot of people pointed this out. This is a, sort of an example of that kind of latent sexism that often tends to go around with sort of women in sports, which is really unfortunate because, you know, you would never really see the men's national team spoken to in such a way. You would never see, like, England tweet out that, well, congratulations to our soccer players or football players, whatever. Now they're going to go back to being husbands and fathers and sons. Right? Like, that would never happen. It would be about, okay, let's go back to being professional football players, go back to your professional sports, your professional leagues, and, you know, that's the end of it. That's not really the same narrative that is being, you know, forced on these women because they're athletes. And, you know, so again, that provoked some immediate backlash. The tweet has since been deleted, and a lot of discussion about that came just from the fact that, okay, we need to perceive these women athletes as athletes and not sort of like this old-timey gendered traditional viewpoint of women who, you know, step out of the house to become an athlete for a day or so and then go back in. That's obviously not the the reality that we have anymore in society. Now, I mean, talking a bit about sort of traditional gender roles, it turns out that one of the other factors that female athletes in the World Cup have to deal with, aside from sort of latent sexism, is also a wage gap as well. Yes, the U.S. team who won the World Cup is set to take home $2 million from FIFA after winning in the final game. Now, that's $33 million less, 94%, than Germany received for winning last year's men's World Cup. And it's $6 million less than the worst teams received at that tournament in Brazil. So just to put that in perspective, the number one women's team gets $2 million. The worst teams in the men's category get $6 million. Something doesn't quite add up there. Now, a lot of commentators have pointed out that this is, in fact, related to the kind of business nature of the sport, and that the women's game, as interesting and compelling as it is simply not as big as the male game. But, you know, this is honestly, I think, a load of crap, because if you want to grow the game, you need women athletes. You need the sport to be treated as an equal, not just by the people who present it, like news reporters and sportscasters, but also the organization that runs it. You can't honestly expect FIFA to act like they take this seriously if they're only going to pay $2 million to the champion team when they're already dealing out, you know, $33 million plus to the winning team of the men's league. It's just ridiculous. And even if, you know, the Women's Cup was not profitable, if it was not as high on the rating scale as other sporting events, as we all know, FIFA isn't exactly languishing in poverty right now. They have the ability to make this right. They have the ability to do the right thing here and pay a totally fair wage or reward, I guess, to the women athletes compared to, you know, a paltry $2 million when you're already dealing out $33 million to, you know, the men's team. It's just not, it's ridiculous. And again, you know, this claim that the women's game is not as financially viable, again, it's not relevant. It's not even important. It doesn't make a real difference because, again, this money, it's not like FIFA needs the money. It's not like they have a shortage of cash floating around. And again, look at what they've been able to accomplish. You know, these women athletes, they have grown the game. They have made this a profound success. The idea that FIFA can turn around and be like, well, it's not quite as viable. Well, really, it looked like pretty viable to me. You had all these people come into Vancouver to attend these events. The game sold out. They were selling at a premium price, higher price than, you know, hockey seats. Clearly, they were doing something right. Clearly, they were making a great impact. The idea that you could turn around and say, well, it's not a big enough game to warrant that kind of award. Well, then, I don't know, scale back the male award? I don't know, because something here is completely out of whack. Either you can afford to pay the same rewards benefits, or you can't. And in which case, you know, looking at the boondoggle that the FIFA Cup was in Brazil, maybe that's a symptom of a problem with the fact that FIFA needs to scale back entirely and to stop dealing out millions upon millions of dollars down a black hole that these communities and infrastructure just can't sustain. So again, you know, this nonsense about the notion that FIFA just, you know, can't afford to cover the same costs, that's BS. This really, what it comes down to, I think, is showing a profound just kind of lack of respect, really, for the female athletes in the World Cup. And again, you know, that's been echoed throughout media. I've seen lots of different stories on, you know, sportscasters going off about, well, you know, why isn't this interesting? And why aren't people paying attention to women's sports? And is women's sports, you know, as viable financially and entertaining as male sports? Instead of talking about the athletes themselves, instead of talking about their own stories, their own, you know, feats, their own games, talking about them like they're not even there, really. So again, you know, on the subject of sports and civil rights intersecting, again, this is another example of why I think we have to be a bit more aware of this in terms of bringing it into the conversation when we talk about social justice. Certainly, these issues aren't going to fix themselves until attention gets thrown on it and until people start to realize, hey, you know what? I saw those World Cup games. They're worth more to FIFA than $2 million. I mean, just, you know, $2 million, that's what they pay to turn the lights on at the stadium. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic here on The Sector. Recently, Vancouver and the greater Vancouver area, such as Burnaby, Richmond, Surrey, New West, etc., we're dealing with an important question related to transit. As the population of this greater Vancouver area is projected to increase by millions of people over the next 60 or so years, the question became, how can transit better facilitate a growing population and a growing sprawl of the greater Vancouver area? Indeed, the interesting thing about this area is that we kind of have a bizarrely laid out city grid. So the question becomes, how can we navigate this grid? How can we get people from, say, Surrey to downtown Vancouver, or to North Vancouver or New Westminster or Richmond? How can we better incorporate this kind of sprawling land that we all occupy? So the question of transit, of course, then becomes, well, how can, based on capacity usage, how can we better service the people here? How can we build new SkyTrains or new subways, put new buses on the road, experiment with light rail? How can we advance our transit infrastructure? So the question, of course, became, well, we're going to have to fund a major expansion, not just to accommodate the rising population, but also to service the existing infrastructure, to make sure that it's up to speed, up to date, working properly, and to make sure that we're able to handle any unforeseen circumstances that come up that require greater capacity. And so this transit referendum was created under the BC Liberals and the Premier, Christy Clark, to ask the population if they would allow a increase in tax in order to fund this transit expansion. And the conversation immediately went into, well, this is a question of, should we raise our taxes to give TransLink a raise? And of course, this wasn't an accurate portrayal. This wasn't really what the conversation was about, but this was the way that it was presented to the population. And the BC Liberals were quite happy to present it this way. The resulting, of course, is that the no side won. So the results we learned a couple days ago here in BC, that the populations of like Vancouver, the greater Vancouver area, Richmond, Surrey, Ladner and whatnot, they do not want to raise taxes to expand transit operations. The fallout of this is going to be pretty extreme. We do not have the infrastructure right now to accommodate the population. We certainly don't have the infrastructure to accommodate the population once it grows in 10, 15, 20 years. So where does that leave us? Well, in a bit of a pickle, but you know, it's interesting to examine this problem and see where we can go with it. Now, the big question, of course, being, okay, so why was this question, this important question on funding transit, on expanding our infrastructure, how did it even come to be a referendum? Well, you know, here's the kicker. According to Richard Zussman of CBC News, it never should have been a question in the first place. There never should have been a referendum. So let's examine this and go into a bit more detail here. The mayors of the Vancouver area did not want this to go to a vote. They explicitly said to the province that they are not in favor of this being put to the voter. Now, you might say, well, why is that? What are they trying to hide? What are they trying to sneak past? But if you look, historically speaking, the mayors have not been in favor of putting infrastructure and transit funding questions to the vote. Nevertheless, the province went ahead and did it anyway. The province had already committed to cover $2.5 billion of the Mayor's Council's plan to improve transit in the region. The federal government indicated that it will provide its share. So the transit plebiscite was all about finding a way to cover the remaining third. The voter turnout, predictably, was just below 50%, which is actually better than most municipalities they saw in the last federal election. But again, you know, we're putting this question to a population less than half of which is going to even participate, and yet they will decide the fate of transit infrastructure in this great Vancouver area. You also have to wonder, you know, how many of the people who are actually voting even use transit or even care about transit. You know, raises some interesting questions right there. So, okay, but first of all, let's think about this. The province had already committed to covering one third of the cost. The federal government was going to cover the other half. Or the other third, pardon me. The public was going to cover the last third. So, you know, let's consider that very carefully. The public was being asked to fork over, and, you know, yeah, they're being asked to pay money, but they're using a service. Better transit has innumerable effects on the economy. It has effects on the quality of life. It has effects on just how accessible your city becomes. There's a lot of, you know, gain to get from that. And at the price that you were being the voter for being asked to pay, that's a pretty good bargain. Getting off with only paying for one third of the expansion when the province and the federal government is going to cover the rest, oh, that's a pretty good deal. Now, it does raise the question, okay, so if you want to expand services, do you have an obligation to go to the voters to approve of it? Some would say yes, some would say no. The reason why transit is such a contentious issue, especially here in the Vancouver area, is because you have to recognize that there is a huge wealth divide here in the city. There are a lot of people who are doing very well for themselves. And then there are a lot of people who live in some pretty harsh conditions who are not doing very well for themselves. And I'm not talking about people who are homeless. I'm not talking about people who live on the downtown east side. We're talking about people who are scraping things by, you know, maybe two jobs, living in a shared apartment. Because, you know, look at the cost of living here in Vancouver. It is skyrocketing. Transit is one of the main thoroughfares for getting through the city, and especially if you have an income that is not sustainable, and in fact most people in Vancouver do not have a sustainable income, it is a major intersection for how you are going to get a job, go to school, and live your life. So, to put this question to the general population, you are potentially strengthening, over-strengthening, over-representing the people who don't need transit, and minimizing the people who do need transit. You know, this is part and parcel of our first-past-the-post system. Now, one of the other interesting factors in this, of course, is that we recently had elections in the Vancouver area. The city of Vancouver recently had an election, as did many of the municipalities around Vancouver, Richmond, Surrey, etc. Many of the mayors explicitly said, we are running on a platform that is pro-transit. The voters overwhelmingly elected them. Well, I mean, in most cases. Now, is that not a mandate from the population to proceed with your plan? Logically, and some people would say, very much so. But okay, let's assume then that the mayor's council had a mandate to govern from the people that elected them. Can we really say that there is no value in getting a general vote on a transit referendum? Well, interestingly enough, I would argue that there actually isn't a lot to gain. Because for the average voter on the street, they are looking at this from a individualistic point of view. Meaning, they are looking at this from, how does this affect me, point of view. And that's nothing. There's nothing wrong with that. That's normal human nature. We're looking at things like, well, do I want my taxes to go up? Well, no, who does, right? So, of course, there's going to be a heavy bias towards the no side. However, the mayors and the transit policy people, they're not looking at this from the point of view of individuals. They're looking at this from a collective point of view. They're trying to ask questions like, what's best for this community? What is best for infrastructure for this community? How can we service the most people in the most effective way possible? These are not questions that the average voter asks themselves before making a mark on a card. What they see is taxes going up, and they see the narrative about TransLink and all the problems that TransLink is having, and they say, do I want to give these people more money? And again, just questions. But that is not the level of discourse that we need to be having about this topic. What's equally interesting is the way that this referendum has been received, not just by the mayor's council and those, of course, who were pro-transit, well, at least pro the expansion, but also the people within the Liberal government itself. Now, keep in mind that Christy Clark government was behind the transit plan. They had promised provincial money. When they campaigned in the last provincial election, they were saying that they were supporting this. Yet putting it to the general public indicates that they really weren't interested in seeing this operation go ahead of plan. Now, in an article on the TAI, there was an email that was sent to Liberal Party members by Gillian Stead, who is a communications officer in the Liberal Party, sent off an email, and among other things said, quote, but as BC Liberal supporters, we should be pleased that our government delivered on our platform commitment to give voters their say. Now, exactly how this was supposed to go over, we don't really know, but what we do know is that there were a lot of angry responses. Michael Geller, the well-known urban planner and media commentator who called Stead's rationale, quote, utter nonsense, also said, quote, while I have been a Liberal supporter for my entire life in BC, I am not at all pleased that the Liberals delivered on their campaign promise. Quite the contrary. For you to send out this message is like rubbing salt in the wounds. What were you thinking? I am sure I am not alone in feeling a total level of disgust with this email message. So, harsh words. Harsh words. And again, you know, I think it speaks to the fact that there are people out there who think that the average Joe or Jane on the street is going to have a better insight into issues like this than the politicians. And, you know, that certainly can be true. I'm not saying it's never true. But again, going back to my point, the mayor's council, the people who are policymakers, they're not thinking about this on an individual level. We're not planning things out with the point of view of, you know, does this raise, you know, Joe Smith's taxes? We're asking, can we raise taxes to service an entire community of people? And that's a very important distinction. We're not just looking at how does this affect you. We're looking at this as how does it affect your community for the next 25 years. There's a big level of distance between asking people what they think of this then and now and asking somebody to consider something 25 years down the road. It just doesn't work. It's not how this level of infrastructure should be implemented. And, you know, the point is being made in the article that this is really sort of a political gambit by Clark to insulate herself so that she doesn't take any blame for this idea of a tax hike. You know, kind of hiding behind this notion that, look, I'm all for lowering taxes. I'm populist. I'm really popular. I'm not going to let them raise taxes. I'm going to give you the chance to say no to that. But again, like, this is not how large-scale projects get organized. This is just shrewd political politicking. And again, I think people have justly called it cowardly. So let's advance this conversation a little bit. Let's talk about the perception this should give us of the Vancouver population, the voter base, our perceptions of ourselves, what we think about when we think of transit. Before we do that, let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, action, wizard, you shall not pass, cut! Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian.
And we are back here on The Sector on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver with me, your host, Ethan Clow. Now, we're talking a bit about the recent transit referendum that failed, or, well, the no side won. So that means that transit here in the Vancouver area is going to be severely handicapped. And what exactly does that mean for the future of Vancouver? What does that mean for ourselves, for the future of how we perceive ourselves? This question was brought up by Pete McMartin in an article on the Vancouver Sun. Really interesting stuff. I encourage you to go check it out if you haven't read it already. Now, the point that he makes is that Vancouver, in general, has a bit of an inflated ego when it comes to how great our city is. You can call it Vancouverism, if you like. This notion that we are an environmentally friendly city full of egalitarian do-gooders who value things like bike lanes, transit, affordable healthcare, and anti-density. We enjoy a city that is beautiful and green, and we're a well-educated, happy, and lovely group of people. In reality, however, McMartin argues, this is not true. Vancouverism, as he says, may be true for two or three neighborhoods in the downtown core, or it might be true for, you know, the odd neighborhood here and there. But in reality, Vancouver is made up of these very separate little communities. And, you know, the greater Vancouver area, of course, is equally as diverse. And the people in this city clearly don't care about transit. He points out that the residents of Vancouver are resistant to change. They abhor densification. They are conventional in their sensibilities, and they're highly dependent on the automobile. More importantly, they're not just dependent on the automobile, they prefer it. Meaning that a lot of people who voted in this referendum have never ever set foot on a bus or been on a SkyTrain. They have really no understanding of how TransLink works. All they really understand is that buses take up room. They don't want their taxes being spent on it. They don't understand how TransLink operates or is governed. All they understand is what they've seen in the newspapers about transit issues and overpaid transit staff, and they don't want anything to do with it. There's no thought or care given to the notion that TransLink, transit in general, overwhelmingly serves the underemployed, the elderly, the disenfranchised, and those who are more downtrodden than they are. Obviously, if you can afford a car to drive everywhere in the Vancouver area, you're doing reasonably well for yourself. And he says you can look at the way that their outrage over a 0.5% rise in sales tax to pay for the public transit expansion, and yet also look at the amount of fuss that's been risen about expanding the road system, building million-dollar bridges, billion-dollar bridges, actually, expanding road maintenance, and all of these things that drivers use. And you realize, well, there really hasn't been the same level of vitriolic outrage over the expansion of these services. And why would you? Because the population of Vancouver, by and large, is pro-car, and they are anti-transit. Now, again, you can argue the semantics of that, or how ultimately how accurate it is, but it's hard to argue with the results. And as McMartin argues, this question isn't so much about whether or not we fund the expansion of transit. The question is, do we even care about transit? And why do we sort of create this mythology about ourselves that Vancouver is a city that is pro-transit, that it is a city that values things like bike lanes and being green and being concerned about the environment and protecting our, you know, beautiful heritage here in the city? You know, many people don't realize, but originally there was going to be a freeway built that would have went through the downtown core of Vancouver. And you think about, you know, just how much people in the downtown core love their little neighborhood. And the idea that potentially could have been simply a giant freeway. You know, this city can rally around things when it feels it really has to. And yet, as much as we like to pretend that affordable transit and the ability to kind of move around the city in an effective and efficient way is part of our ethos here, in reality, it's not really. It's much more focused on a kind of more selfish point of view. And again, not to be so negative, but it's more focused on what's going to affect me directly or my community. And very, very little focus on what's going to affect the city as a whole, what's going to affect the greater Vancouver area as a whole. And again, when talking about the question of dodging a 0.5% rise in sales tax, which again, woohoo, where does that leave development of the Vancouver area? Because again, if we're talking about transit, we're also talking about expansion. And you can't expand a city and do so in a way that makes sense without thinking about, okay, how are we going to service these areas? Look at the Cambie Road area here in Vancouver. It's serviced by a SkyTrain, and it's a great area. People love that area. The downtown core, extremely well serviced by transit. Again, look at the benefits. Look at the restaurants and businesses and development in the downtown core that is worth a lot of money, that is bringing a lot of strength to the economy. Broadway, again, look at how the areas that are serviced by transit that have great responsive service, look at how much more they benefit than the areas that are transit dead zones. Now, if we keep having to expand the city, and we have to because it's growing, how are we going to make sure that our development reflects that? so that our development is not built in this kind of endless sprawl where the only opportunity for getting around or moving about is your car. And again, I mean, consider the fact that we are moving into an age of climate change. Look at all the forest fires. Look at the effect it's been having on the city. If we are going to grow and advance Vancouver, the Vancouver area, we need to have a city that's adaptable. We need to have infrastructure in place that allows us to adapt to the changing way of life that we're going to have to adopt because of, well, climate change. If we have a city that is unresponsive to bus lanes, or a city that is unavailable for sky trains or subways or light rail, if we have a city that can't accommodate bike lanes and alternate modes of transportation that doesn't put more CO2 in the atmosphere, what are we going to do? Like, how do we expect this city to compete internationally and progress in terms of becoming greener, in terms of becoming more energy efficient, and becoming more cost efficient? There isn't a way forward, you know, if we're not prepared to expand transit and value the impact that it has on the city. And again, you know, this is sort of the broad theme of the article in The Sun by Peter McMartin. If we're not prepared to respect transit and respect the fact that it has a beneficial net gain for the city, if we're only going to look at this issue in terms of a kind of jealous tax grab, then we really need to reevaluate how this city perceives itself and how this city intends to go forward into the future. So, listeners, what do you think on this complicated issue? Do you think that Vancouver's identity has been seriously affected or, in fact, jeopardized by the transit referendum? If so, or if you want to share your thoughts, let us know. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com, sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And of course, we're on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. You can tweet me at Ethan Clow or at Sector Podcast. And again, you can subscribe to the podcast over at citr.ca or at thesectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And get all of our show notes as well as past episodes from there as well. So I look forward to hearing from you. I'm very curious to see what your thoughts on this are. Did you vote? Did you vote yes? Or did you vote no? And ultimately, what do you want to see from TransLink and transit infrastructure in the future? Definitely, there's a very interesting conversation that's going on about this, and it'll be very curious to see how this affects Vancouver development. Well, anyway, this has been episode 49 of The Sector, and since we are running out of time, I should wrap things up fairly quickly. I want to thank you all for tuning in and listening to the show today. Of course, we'll be back next week, same time, same channel here on CITR. And of course, we will be broadcasting from our new studio here at the Nest here at UBC. If you haven't got a chance, please come down to the station to take a look. It's a brand new studio, really awesome looking. You should really come take a look. It's just right front and center in the new building. Unlike before, where we were kind of upstairs and kind of hidden away, this one is far more open, way more friendly, and hopefully it will draw in some more programmers. So if you're a student here at UBC, you got some ideas, we want to hear from you. That includes me, too. So if you have any ideas for me, let me know. I'd be happy to have you stop by to visit. It'd be a very fun experience. Anyway, this is The Sector Podcast. This is your host, Ethan Clow, saying thank you once again for tuning in. We will see you all next week here on The Sector. Stay tuned for Up on the Roof, coming up next on CITR. We will see you all next week. Goodbye.